The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Armitstead.
Football is a beautiful game. It needs to be played beautifully.
Some fella in London, England, named Brian Clough. I heard that this fella talks too much. They say he's another Muhammad Ali. Now, Clough, I've had enough. Stop it.
Hazel was last seen walking up Rooms Lane towards her home in Bradstock Garden yesterday evening, 12th of December. Claire Kempley disappeared on her way home from Morley Grange Junior and Infants, Morley. Claire left
the mother and the father in their crumpled clothes and greasy hair, him flicking at the dandruff on his collar,
Claire said goodbye,
fiddling with her wedding ring.
Was last seen walking down Victoria Road towards her home at approximately 4 o'clock. This was the last time anyone saw
both
Claire,
twitching at the bang and the wail of a microphone being switched on, looking for all the world more the sinners than the sinned against.
I feel that I've made, like, fictions of the facts, which was my way to represent it, because your memory is unreliable, and I was a child at that time, and I felt fiction was, like, an honest way to do it.
I think you're the best young manager in this country.
Thank you. I'm the best old one, too.
Somewhere near here lives the killer they call the Yorkshire Ripper. His five-year career of killing began in the red light district.
Machiavellian scheme to like dominate all the media. When Red Riding was on the TV and when Madame United was on general release, I was actually in Tokyo. And, you know, I got like emails from friends saying, you know, I can't go down the Asda without, you know, you staring out of every magazine.
We have to park on him.
Fine, it'll cost you 25 grand.
Who do you think you are?
Brian Clough.
When Hazel did not return from school, Mr. and Mrs. Adkins contacted Morley Police, and a search was launched early yesterday evening. As some of you are aware, the police were joined in this search by more than 100 local beats.
David Peace is a phenomenon, a determinedly northern writer imbued with the drama of local events who nevertheless moved to Tokyo, originally to earn his living teaching English. From there, he's written about the 1980s miners' strike, child murders in the north of England, and two legendary football managers. His latest novel is about Liverpool's Bill Shankly. So what is this fascination with soccer bosses?
I think I was drawn to them both for very different reasons. With Clough, it was simply the mystery of what had happened in these 44 days in 1974. Bill Shankly was a bit different because I really did want to write a different kind of narrative, a different kind of story to the ones I'd been writing before, something slightly more uplifting maybe and inspirational.
Now, you say uplifting and inspirational, but the second third of this novel, he's actually retired and he has nothing to do. So the first half is titled Shankly Among the Scousers. The second half is Every Day is Sunday, because he's bored and he's actually dying of a broken heart, you could say. So uplifting.
I think there are some very dark moments in that retirement half of the book, but there is this kind of myth, if you like, that Shankly died of a broken heart. I don't actually subscribe to that entirely, and I think that's what I tried to get across in the book, because he had said, you know, my life is my work is my life, and I think he hadn't fully realised what retirement would mean. And so the initial part of a retirement, the first few years, was very painful, and there were some very dark moments. There was misunderstandings with the club on both sides, and he felt like cut off for a period. But what I hope in the final quarter of the whole novel is that I think what sustained him, and why I think the idea that he died of a broken heart is wrong, is that, you know, this was a man who fans could go up and see him every day at his house. They could knock on the door and he would invite them in for a cup of tea. They would stop him on the street. They would talk to him in cafes, on trains. And he can have had no doubt the affection and the reverence that the Liverpool fans had for him. And I think that sustained him. And I also think the penultimate chapter of the novel takes place in Paris after Liverpool have won their third European Cup. You know, a lot of the research came from message boards and fan forums and all the stories that are told. And there was one story of a man who'd seen in this big celebration party just at the bar a few months before he died, quietly talking to Bob Paisley, who took over for him. There's Shankly and Paisley just in conversation together. So I don't think at the end there was any acrimony.
You start the novel with the three words, repetition, repetition, repetition. And my goodness, there is some repetition in it. On page 519, I found 54 bills. Tell me why you've done that.
the style of the book and the heavy use of repetition was informed or inspired by how I wanted to portray him. To me, I was trying to paint a portrait of a man with words, again, inspired by something he said himself, football. This is, he said this in his retirement, but football is like a river. It's relentless and it's hard and it goes on and on and on. And, you know, we're about to, you know, in England, we're about to start a Premier League football season, and we know it's going to be the same number of games and the same teams. And there is this tremendous amount of repetition, the ritual that goes on season after season. And I really wanted to convey the enormous sacrifice and struggle that Bill Shankly had been through and inspired other people to go through with him at Liverpool Football Club. So the repetition really is mainly in the first half of the book, when it's detailing taking Liverpool from the second division in 1959 right up to 1974, basically creating the modern Liverpool Football Club we know now. The work that was involved in that, you know, this was something that, you know, Bill Shankly thought of, you know, every waking moment. He was obsessed by football, and yet it was so repetitious and exhausting and draining for him. If you read a sentence and it says, you know, Bill Shankly trained with a team every day for 15 years, I don't think that really does it justice. And so that the whole style was informed by that. I mean, just to give another example, I mean, people have said, why do you keep repeating Anfield? So, for example, it's Bill walks into the dressing room, the Anfield dressing room. Why not just, you know, Bill walked into the dressing room? But, you know, for Bill Shankly, it wasn't just any dressing room. It was the Anfield dressing room. Anfield was this, like, almost mythical place for him. It was the most important place in the world, and it wasn't something, you know, he switched on and off for press conferences or the programme notes. This is what he felt every moment of his life, and I just was really trying to convey that. There was some thought behind it. It wasn't just a pretentious style exercise.
What occurred to me is that you have the repetition of fullness, and then you have the repetition of emptiness. And can I just point you to this page? And I'd love you to read just this little bit from the page that I've just mentioned.
It was 4:30 in the afternoon. Bill had washed the car, Bill had mowed the lawn, Bill had weeded the garden, and Bill had tidied up the shed. It was 4:30 in the afternoon, and there was nothing more to do. That was it. That was all. No more work to be done.
So what occurred to me about that is that it's almost poetry, isn't it?
How I write the book is to write it, I suppose, in fragments, and then put it together into prose, and then I read it aloud. So I read it over and over again until the rhythm is right, and so it's coming from poetry. Yes, I suppose, yeah.
Now, Mark Lawson, who reviewed it for The Guardian, and he actually did love it, said, the most obvious risk of Red or Dead is that it contains too much football for most fans of hardcore modernist fiction, and too much hardcore modernist fiction for most fans of football. I can see his point.
As I say, it was just my obsession with creating the portrait. There are passages when I've been reading on this book tour that are, you know, incredibly funny, and the audience are laughing. But my editor said to me one day, it's interesting you choose these funny passages and not the passage for, you know, not the 8 pages when he's washing his car, for example.
You've nodded at a lot of genres. For example, in the Red Riding Quartet, you nodded at crime fiction. This you're nodding at sort of the soccer novel. But actually, it seems to me that your project underlying it is a State of the Nation portrayal. Do you think that's true?
I think that's definitely there, but I don't get out of bed and think I'm going to write the State of the Nation novel. But I do think, though, that a book says as much about the time it's written in as the time it's written about. And I think this book is very much informed by, you know, the 2 years when I was living in Britain from 2009 to 2011, and then returning to Japan to write it. This, though, is very, very purposely a socialist novel. And I think that, you know, to try and write about Bill Shankly without writing a socialist novel would be impossible and wrong. You know, in his retirement, Bill Shankly took this job at Radio City in Liverpool, and he was given a Saturday lunchtime show, and he was able to invite anybody he wanted onto the programme. And the first person he invited on was Harold Wilson, who was a serving Prime Minister. And I thought that was just incredible, that this retired football manager writes to Harold Wilson, and Harold Wilson immediately accepts and comes up to Liverpool and does this interview. And it's, you know, I was very kindly lent the tape by a journalist who'd been the ghostwriter for Bill Shankly. And I think this tape is, you know, while people on Merseyside would have heard it, I just thought this was an incredible tape that no one outside of Merseyside had heard, and probably now not many people would remember if they had heard it. And it's quite a long part of the second half of the book. And I remember that my editor and I at Faber, we did wonder about cutting it, but it just became really hard to cut, because I think there's a great relevance and resonance to what they're talking about to now. I mean, For example, they touch on Europe, which is still an issue for us now. But you know, just to give one example, I just found the way they were talking about their backgrounds, their, you know, how they came to socialism, the influence of Christianity on them, and there's this kind of Christian socialism that, you know, I recognise from like my grandfather. And then there is a second interview just before he died, and Harold Wilson was on that programme as well. And that's the interview where probably Bill Shankly's most famous quote about football's not a matter of life and death, it's more important than that, comes from. It's very sad when he says that, because he's saying it as a moment of regret, having not spent more time with his family, and really is sad at not seeing his children grow up.
His relationship with his wife Ness is really touching, and she particularly, he does a lot of washing of the floor and washing of cars, and she's always saying, do you really have to do it?
The way he coped with defeat was to scrub the oven. But one thing in their family that was really special and that he always had to be there for was this Sunday lunch. And you know, if Liverpool had lost on a Saturday, then he would scrub the oven and do everything, and that was how he worked through the defeat. Everything he did it to the best of his ability. So you know, if he was, you know, shining his shoes, they would have to be, you know, as shiny as he could possibly make them. So in retirement, all this energy that he's devoted to making Liverpool Football Club the most successful team in England, he's now doing on his garden and on washing his car. And that's from a passage I just read. He'd finished it all by 4:30 in the afternoon. And so I was really trying to show that this man saw himself as a very ordinary man, an ordinary man who did extraordinary, heroic, you might say, things.
The Damned United upset Brian Clough's family and people in Leeds. How has this gone down in Liverpool?
Before Faber announced the book, I thought it was really important that we contact the Shankly family just to warn them. I think with the Damned United, we'd been a little bit naive in that really, I just didn't think the Clough family would be interested in this book. And it wasn't a question, you know, I just thought, never entered my head they would even want to read it. And so I was very worried that if we didn't contact them, they you know, that people might doorstep them and say, you know, this book's coming. And what. So through contacts, I wrote to Bill Shankly's granddaughter, Karen. But then actually, I mean, and this has been, I mean, the most, you know, moving thing for me is that, you know, that she and the other grandchildren, I mean, I did an event last night in Liverpool and met them for the first time, because this had all been conducted by email, have been just incredibly supportive. And I think that, to be honest, I think that's a real Shankly quality, that they think the best in people, and it, you know, brings out the best in people.
You live in Japan, you're writing about these sort of big periods of British history. How does that feel? Do you think that gives you a perspective that actually is helpful, or is it seems a rather weird project for you to be doing?
It works for me, and as I say, from 2009 to 2011, we moved back to Dewsbury, where I'm from. And during that period, which was it wasn't a negative period in terms of, like, you know, seeing my parents every day and the grandchildren and so forth, and being bilingual and all these kind of personal things, but I found it impossible to write. I was writing, but it was, I was going to say not writing well, but even worse than usual. But there's something about Tokyo that just allows me a certain amount of, I think it's as much discipline really, and not having distractions, you know, not being tempted to watch Sky Sports News all morning to see if this transfer goes through. So I think it gives me a certain amount of discipline, and that, yes, I do think, particularly writing about the past, the recent past, you know, I'm always trying to recreate the language. You know, language just changes all the time. So, you know, I was able to sit in my little room in Tokyo just with Bill Shankly's voice, just with the interviews and the cassettes, and not really be distracted. You know, it allowed me the distance and also the discipline to concentrate.
David Peace. Now, there's been a lot of chat around the festival site about what sort of readers will read this book. So we decided to go out and about and find out just what the crossover is between book lovers and sport.
The occasional thing I read in the newspaper about sport, but I don't read about sport in books at all.
Hi, I'm Chris from Bridgevale, and a good sports book I read, although it's not really about sports, is the Go-Between. It's a great catch on the boundary by a young boy, which is just like winning the Ashes on Monday.
My name's Jonas. I'm reading It's All About the Bike by Robert Penn. It's a really good book, and it's inspiring me to build a bicycle.
My name is Adrian Graham. I'm currently reading The Long Way Back by Harry Enfield's dad.
Hi, I'm Nicole, and I'm from Edinburgh. I've picked up several autobiographies over the years on famous footballers. I totally love football, love all the big games, Manchester United, Chelsea, Tottenham. I've read Wayne Rooney, Gaza, David Beckham. Totally love David Beckham. He's totally amusing and beautiful. And Wayne Rooney is a great football player. And Gaza's got an amazing celebrity life story. And he's always in the papers, so it's quite interesting to read about him.
Hello, my name is Ian. I've recently read a book about the Blue British Lions. It was a tremendous book. It was about the fact that the British Lions traditionally paid in blue up until, I think it was before the Second World War, because I have a relation that used to play for the British Lions in 1905, toured on the 1905 New Zealand tour, and hadn't really realised that he would have played in blue rather than red.
Hello, I'm Damien Barr, and the best sports book I've read is Vertigo by John Cruise, because it's not actually about football, it's really about depression.
My name's Rupert Thompson. My favourite sports book is Touching the Void by Joe Simpson, especially the bit where he sings Brown Girl in the Ring to himself to help him survive.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I live in Edinburgh, and I don't really read books about sports, but when I was a young adult, I read a book called Tangerine by Edward Bloor, which is about how a young boy finds acceptance in society and grows more courageous through playing football at his school. And he comes from a very difficult family background where he's kind of pushed to the side and marginalised. So being a goalie in the football team gives him purpose for his life.
Thompson flicked a bale with his right.
He monitored, tried to do the splits over it, and unfortunately the inner part of his thigh must have just removed the bale.
He just didn't quite get his leg over.
Anyhow, he did very well indeed, batting 131 minutes and hit 3 fours. Agus, do stop it. Lawrence, always entertaining, batted for 35 minutes, hit a 4 over the wicket. Agus, for goodness sake.
Those of you who love sport will recognise the voices there of Brian Johnson and his successor, Jonathan Agnew, from Test Match Special. Jonathan dropped in at the festival with his very handsome dog to talk about his new book covering 100 years of cricket journalism. Time to let our cricketing producer, Tim Mabey, take the stage.
Jonathan, you're best known, obviously, for your cricket commentating, but in a way, everything's sort of changed since the arrival of so much broadcast commentary. I mean, there's a big difference in skills, isn't there, between, say, the good old blithe Brian Johnston and the likes of Neville Carders?
Huge difference. I mean, I suppose, if I'm honest, I'm much more the Brian Johnston variety than the Neville Carders variety. I mean, Neville's writing still stands absolutely the test of time. Acerbic, colourful, descriptive, writing about the characters that I think cricket allows you to write about. I always often use Monty Panesar as an example of where I think we as cricket writers and broadcasters are very lucky, in that you see in someone like Monty, a very skilled bowler, so you see someone at the top of their game, you see someone who's not very good at batting but tries terribly hard, so you can write about them also from that perspective, and then fielding, anything goes. So in other words, you have a very serious sportsman at the top of his game, but also rather a comedy figure when he's fielding. And that's where cricket, I think, gives you so much scope to write about these characters that other sports don't. Footballer just plays well all the time. Cricket offers you the chance to see someone at the top of the game, but also when they're battling to do their other skill, if you like.
To bring out their humanity, in a sense.
Well, that's right, and that's what I think what we try and do on the radio. You try and let the listener get some sort of idea as to what they look like, but actually the character that they are. And you might be right sometimes, you might be wrong sometimes, but I think you try and you don't do it in black and white. You've got to try and do it in colour. And that's where, you know, cricket commentary, I think, just gives you so much scope to do that.
Of course, I'm just old enough to remember John Arlott, who was the handover, but he was famous as a broadcaster because of the fact he also was a poet, and he brought that into his commentary.
Absolutely, and I'm sure, like the rest of us, John would have, perhaps not sitting on his lawnmower as I do, but he'd have thought about a line, thought about something, and tucked it away, and then brought it out when the moment was right. You know, because that's how it works. I often think of things on the motorway and think, that's a funny line, I'll just tuck it away. John would have done that, Brian Johnson would have done that as well. But see, I never really heard much John Arlott. I was more of a Johnner's man, I think, and he had a huge influence on me to sit beside him and watch him working and listen to him and get some idea of his timing, when to be funny, when to be serious, when to bring in somebody else, when to read a letter, all that sort of thing. It had a big impact on the way I did it. I mean, John was a more serious character, but again, they provided, both of them, the perfect balance. So the listener had 40 minutes of perfect balance, serious, colourful, beautiful, poetic, bit of fun and nonsense on the other, isn't it?
But to bring you back to the writing again, I did look up a Wisden quote which says that cricket writing is rather dominated by the English and characterised by a reverence for the game, its character and ethos.
Yeah, that's lovely, isn't it? I mean, has any other sport attracted such writing as cricket does? I don't think it can have done, because, you know, I say that the depth on offer for a cricket writer, not only in terms of length of time, for goodness sake, but in drama, ebb and flow, a test match gives you so much. And he's always been given a lot of space to write. And they have been essays, really, rather than match reports. I think certainly the likes of Cardus and Arlott would have described their writing as an essay or prose rather than a match report.
Which do you think, though, in this very thorough collection that you've made, it shows the more importance, the knowledge of the game or that style of writing?
Well, that's why it was a balance. You know, that's why I think, and I was asked some interesting questions in the chat just now about, there's always this eternal, not conflict, but discussion about, do you need to play cricket or do you not need to play cricket to do the job properly? And I think the book demonstrates that you can do both. And we've got Don Bradman writing about bodyline in that book, which is fantastic. I mean, the man who it was designed, of course, to eliminate. And, of course, there's Cardus and there's the modern Gideon Haig, a wonderful Australian writer. Richie Beno writing about the last tied test, you know, he was at the other end. So I hope that you do get the balance between someone who'd been out there and done it and describing what he had done.
Yes, I must get you to tell about that friend of yours who's a writer but hasn't really played much cricket.
That's right.
And sussed more than you did.
Indeed, because he could just watch it from a non-player's perspective.
So who is he?
He's Martin Johnson, who for many years has written about cricket. He's an independent Telegraph correspondent, now at Sunday Times, very humorous writer. But he had made his living out of watching cricket. And he was talking about David Gower's fallibility outside the leg stump and saying that the Australians are bowling there on purpose. And I said, no, of course they're not, you know, because as a bowler, you would not bowl there on purpose. You just couldn't program yourself to do it. He said, of course they are, look and watch. And of course they got him out on this one occasion on tour in Adelaide, I remember, and I would have shook Martin by the hand and said, you're right. From what I've just seen, you were bang on. It went against everything that sort of the player would have said. But the fellow who had hardly bowled a ball in his life was right.
Two people that you've worked with, and you say in the book, you know, in a sense, where they were, to an extent, your mentors, Richie Beno and Christopher Martin Jenkins. I mean, what is special about their writing?
Richie is the most professional person that I've ever worked with. And so his clear-cut description, of course, of that last over in the Thai Test, for instance, is classic Richie, you know, analysing every ball and the dismissal and how it was chaos that was ensuing in Brisbane this day. But on a personal level, I mean, to work with Richie Beno is just something that is a total privilege. Ice cold, under pressure. And by pressure, I mean in television. And I'm a radio man, but I had to do some television presentation with Rich, which involved the countdown, the minute clock, which I do all the time on the radio. And it's easy if you can see a clock, but that horrible voice, 59, 58, 57, and I got it all wrong the first couple of times. And Richie said, we've got a problem here, Jonathan. I said, we have, Richie. What are we going to do? He said, when it starts, he said, you ask me a question and I'll talk to, how long do you want? I said, seven. He said, fine. So he would talk to seven. I'll then say, well, thanks, Richie, that's great. Look at the camera. And there we are, great game today, West Indies, Australia. Tomorrow it's England, West Indies. See you then, good night. And that was how we got around it. So I'll always be eternally grateful to Richie. Christopher, again, someone who, of course, only played club cricket, really. And yet, probably the best modern example of someone who can make it to the very top and be one of the most respected voices and writers in the game without having bowled a professional ball. Dearly missed.
What was it that he saw, CMJ? I mean, I know I've worked along with him myself, but what was it he saw, his approach, that kind of made him distinguished?
Very traditional. So he would have had a lot to say on the spirit of cricket this summer, for instance, because, you know, he was, as an MCC president, that is what the MCC stands for, the spirit of cricket. It's their, you know, their logo, almost. It's there on all their billboards. So he would have found this summer difficult, with batsmen not walking, with the DRS system playing tricks. He would have loved writing about it, but he'd have been very forthright, and he'd have said that there were things that were wrong. He was a fan. I mean, if Christopher could have gone and got players' autographs, he was that sort of individual. You know, he was a genuine, old-fashioned, prep school-type cricket lover who took that love on to the very top. It'll be a long, long time before we encounter someone like Christopher Martin Jenkins again.
And to take that spirit of cricket idea of yours up, you are, I'm glad to say, happy to include some of what I call the mad amateurs, like Harry Thompson, for whose team I once played against a Penguin stop play. I mean, why are they important?
But that's what cricket's all about, isn't it? It is about those intrepid village cricketers who go out there after sheeting rain on a Saturday, clear the cows off the field and go and play village cricket and all sorts of cricket. I mean, up mountains, on frozen lakes. People play cricket in the most bizarre places. And I also like to try and relate to the club secretary, you know, the poor fellow who's there in his office with sheaths of paperwork trying to run two or three teams, as they do have to do these days increasingly, unfortunately, with the ECB regulations. That's a different kettle of fish. But there is so much enthusiasm for cricket out there by people for whom it is the most important thing on the planet.
And there's a special kind of sportsmanship, isn't there?
Well, I hope so. I think there still is at that level. It's vanishing, I think, at the top. But it's their job. And we have to remember that. But that doesn't mean to say that they're not also an example. And they have to remember that. So somewhere in the middle, you get the line.
Jonathan Agnew there. Now, Tim, it's back in the box for you to prepare for tomorrow's podcast. We'll be talking to Booker long-listed Charlotte Mendelssohn and taking stock of the World Writers' Conference.
Broad, and he bowls, and that's lofted up to mid-off, and there it is! Stuart Broad takes his sixth wicket. And England have won. They've won the series, they've won the Ashes. And they've won this by 74 runs, I reckon, with Australia bowled out for 224. A fight against the light.
The Books podcast from guardian.co.uk.